The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our best ever Wi-Fi all around your home, your world is limitless.
Now, Italia 90 is the subject of a new exhibition opening today at the Little Museum of Dublin. It, of course, had a profound impact on the country and was central to the brilliant novel and subsequent film, The Van. Its author, Roddy Doyle, is on the line. Good morning, Roddy.
Hello.
We better start, I suppose, with the death of Jack Charlton just a couple of weeks ago and the almost spooky timing of it.
Yes, it's as if he somehow choreographed the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because I think the Italia 90 was being somewhat bypassed because of the lockdown.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't getting the attention that a lot of lesser events get when their anniversaries come along. Mm. And then he died.
Yeah. And
I suppose some of us thought he was going to be a bit immortal. You know, the notion of Jack Charlton dying was just ludicrous. But there you go.
And you published a pretty poignant two-point... They're usually poignant anyway, the two-points tribute to Big Jack himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it had that line, "I feel like me dad's after dying."
Yeah.
But that was it. He was Ireland's dad, wasn't he?
In a way, yeah. I mean, at the time, I didn't think it. You know, say Italia 90, I was 32. I had a father of my own.
Yeah.
And one's plenty. You know, my father was a very lively man. There wouldn't have been room for another father in my life, you know. But I think that's what he became almost, really, because I remember when he got the job in 1986, I don't remember anybody thinking, this is great news. He wasn't anybody's first choice. He almost got in by accident. And I went to the first friendly game, and it wasn't a glittering affair. My outstanding memory is that Neville Southall, the Wales goalkeeper, broke his leg, you know, in a friendly because of the state of the pitch, really. He landed in a ditch, you know. So it wasn't a great thing, but gradually then. And I went to some of the friendlies before 1988, the friendly games. There was one against Bulgaria, if I remember rightly, in Lansdowne Road. And because there were no floodlights, they were on a Wednesday afternoon, and I was a teacher, so I had the afternoon off. And I could sit on the terrace and have a perfect view of the game. There were so few people there, you know.
Right.
And then gradually, as you know, it took off. And by 1990, it was a national... To say it was a national obsession is, to put it, you know, is an understatement. And it stopped being about the football, because I think if you look at the football, some of those games were pretty dreadful. But it was the atmosphere, the sense that this is us, Christ, we're like this, we can do this. You know, it was amazing. Extraordinary.
Almost nobody else around the world remembers World Cup 90.
No, it's like, not one of the better ones. No.
I think it had the fewest goals, actually, of any World Cup ever.
Yeah.
And but we were totally, totally consumed. Do you remember vividly the run-up to it?
I remember, yeah, because, in part because I was really looking forward to it. As a football fanatic, really,
yeah,
since I was a little boy. And I suppose at one time you kind of give up on the idea of ever taking part in this, you know, despite the fact we'd seen Northern Ireland in 1982,
mm-hmm,
and I think in 86 as well, it just seemed it was never going to happen, and then it did. And at the time, I'd started writing The Van, the novel, in November 1989.
Right.
And as the excitement began to build up, I thought, well, I could launch The Van at the same time as the World Cup. And if it takes off, great. And if it doesn't, I'd be editing it anyway, so it won't be in the book.
Yeah.
But it did take off. And I was writing those long chapters where their business is immediately chaotic, wild success outside the pub. You know, like the day after the matches and the day after that, my head pounding, you know, absolutely dead, right, you know, but delirious in some way. So I think if I'd been in Italy, I'd never written the book, I think. And also, if I hadn't been a football fan, I don't think I'd written the book, because it was the energy of it all. It was so, I have great memories of it, very, very, very vivid memories. I went to all the qualifying games.
Right.
And all the home games. I wasn't at any of the away games. So I went to all of them, and the gradual build-up, the belief, it's going to happen. And then, you know, what should have been the easiest game of the lot, really, away to Malta, it became, typically enough, really, a nail-biting affair, you know.
A bit like in the World Cup itself, where Egypt Should have been a prospect that we...
Oh, you know, that's the worst game in history, really. Can we move on?
So the van is like a contemporaneous account. You're writing it hungover after the matches.
Yes, big chunks of it, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. The hard work then was later on editing it, but also, you know, there was... If you like, I wrote the centre of the book was written then, but the problem came later after the World Cup when I had to come up with an ending and, you know, make a novel out of it as opposed to the wild ramblings of a football fan.
Can we just take a little step back and I want to look at Italia 90 because obviously it was Jack Charlton. We didn't hardly see him as English, even though he was, he was in the World Cup 1966 with England. But the whole team, none of them earned a living in Ireland.
No.
And yet they managed to represent this kind of much broader view of Irishness that we ever had before.
Yeah, that's one of the things. There's a great image in the little museum exhibition. It's a map of Ireland and Britain with arrows indicating where the players came from.
Right.
You know, and despite, you know, popular myth, quite a few of the arrows point at Ireland. But the one that got me was Kevin Sheedy. I thought I knew the name of every town everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
There's a football team from every town everywhere or a train station that you look out the window. Oh, there it is. But Kevin Sheedy came from a place I never heard of. And
go on, what is it?
I can't remember. I suppose it's a big enough enticement for people to go in and have a go.
Yeah, it's in the little museum. That's like
But I think it was really perfect in many, many ways, you know, because what Irish family doesn't have family living abroad?
Yeah.
People who are passionate about their Irishness, more so than we are. They'd embarrass you, you know, on occasion, as you know, with Irish dancing and stuff like that. And it just seemed right and proper that, you know, Ray Houghton, for example, whose father was from Donegal, if I remember right, should be allowed to consider himself an Irishman and should, you know, should score against England, you know. So it was a bigger definition of Ireland. And I think that was significant as well, because I think around about that time, really the notion that Ireland was an island unto itself and had, you know, nothing to do with the rest of the world was well and truly dying. And we began to look outside to really become Europeans, I think. And I think that bringing in people who weren't living in Ireland anymore was just seemed to represent that somehow. And I think Jack Charlton, his brand of Englishness was important.
Right.
He wasn't Jacob Rees-Mogg.
No.
Do you know? He didn't really have to fight too hard to be liked. He was from Northern England. And anybody who spent time, say, in Liverpool or Manchester, they all feel a little bit familiar, those places, because they're so, in many senses, Irish. Do you know? Now, he had nothing Irish about him, but he was just that Northern, blunt, honest, decent, for want of a better word, man.
When he got off the plane, the Aer Lingus plane home from Dublin, which was rechristened St. Jack, the actual plane, the scenes of the homecoming after, you know, he was a glorious defeat in a way, it was kind of approaching mania, wasn't it?
It was unbelievable. I mean, I was on O'Connell Bridge. I lived on Abbey Street at the time and I spent literally hours on O'Connell Bridge waiting for the buses to come down O'Connell Street. And it looked visually as if they were being carried, you know, carried by the crowd up along, gradually along the street. I've never seen crowds like it. Yeah. I haven't since. It was just extraordinary. And people were hanging from everything. I believe some of the men on the buses were actually quite frightened that somebody was going to get injured.
That's right.
But from where I was, it was just unbelievable. When the buses actually passed, it was a bit of a letdown. It was just a gang of lads in place, waving and looking drunk.
You expect something supernatural to happen, don't
just
you?
Just a little bit. The buses, the wheels were actually on the tarmac and they were going very slowly. But I had this notion that it was like two very colourful, very packed coffins being carried down O'Connell Street.
I mean, it was really pride, wasn't it? And
oh, it was brilliant.
The lads represent diaspora. Do you think we've never really had a moment since then? Like that?
Do you know, it might sound a bit weird, but I think, yeah, in terms of cause for celebration, yeah, possibly we haven't had a moment like it since. Mm. I can't think of any. And it was a moment that seemed to linger, actually. I do think there's a certain truth in that we were never quite the same again. I think, you know, it's hard to quantify. It's hard, there's no statistic will ever prove it or disprove it, but it just felt that way. But in a certain way, I think this might sound daft, but I felt that around about March of this year, where there was a level of unity, March and April, a level of unity and a level of we're in this together.
Yeah.
A sense of that here, which seemed to be absent in other places where they speak the English language.
Yes. Yeah.
And I felt it was in a quiet way, a little bit similar. Do you know?
Yeah.
That might be daft, but that was my feeling at the time.
I suppose there was the quiet authority of what had been an unpopular government.
And yes.
There was a sense of that we should all just be sound about it.
Yes. Yeah.
And you don't get that anywhere else, do you?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Where they speak the English language. Nostalgia sometimes, it gives you that warm, fuzzy feeling. And if we miss because of the thing, in June particularly, the 30-year anniversary of Italia 90, but Big Jack's passing kind of put it into focus again. Are we in danger of looking back a little bit too rosily at that era? Because 1990 was a fairly grim time in Ireland.
It was, but I think it's also important not to exaggerate it, really.
Yeah.
You know, I was teaching in Kilbarrick and Greendale Community School, and statistically, yeah, you could see the unemployment rate was really high, and a lot of the people I was teaching were emigrating and going away. But at the same time, there was an extraordinary energy and a level of wit and great, great spirit. And you know, when things began to pick up, it didn't surprise me all that much. It was as if there was potential lurking there all along. So, yes, it was grim in some ways, but there was a lot of great stuff happening at the same time, you know. And I think, in a way, the World Cup encapsulated that somehow. But I do agree with you about nostalgia. But the thing is that looking back at the past isn't just nostalgic.
You mean it's lessons to be learned?
I think so, in a way, yeah. And it's like the similarities. When you're reading these, I've read several books about the plagues, you know, the various plagues. Most recently, Emma Donoghue's one, Pull of the Stars. And it's all so familiar, you know.
Yeah.
The messages that are being conveyed to people, you know, people washing their hands or not washing their hands, coughing at each other, not coughing at each other. Saying there's nothing going on, and there's other people saying it's the end of the world. It's all so familiar. It's actually quite reassuring. You know, we've always been Egypts.
We don't change. A text is coming in, 51551. Kevin Sheedy's family came from Dara, Ballyee in County Clare. He was born in Bulleth Wells in Wales.
Yes.
Bulleth Wells, yeah, that's news to me as well.
Doesn't ring off. I bet you never went through there.
No, definitely not. The van. Have you seen the film in recent years?
No, I haven't seen it since it was released.
That's something you do generally, isn't it? You haven't seen The Commitments either? Or...
No, I don't. I don't go back and look at the stuff. No.
So no nostalgia for you there in that area.
No, maybe eventually. I just feel I feel a bit uncomfortable looking at stuff.
Yeah,
that
sure,
I've done,
sure.
You
that's,
know?
That's the way you look at it. But there are kind of echoes of it, particularly the kind of the sense of self worth, the men as the breadwinner. And just the work, I suppose, and it's 1990 and now we're 30 years on. Has things changed for people of, like, you don't want to separate people, but of people of that class?
People?
Of that class. I mean, you, Rosie went out on St. Patrick's Night.
Yes.
About the homeless crisis. And it's again that sense of, you know, people want to obviously just be independent.
Yeah, people want... Yes, I think, you know, in some ways it's quite distressing because in many ways things haven't changed. I think they have in some ways. I suspect... I'm not really qualified to talk about younger people, but I suspect that they're less defined by what they do. Now, that could be a class thing, you know, but I don't think they're as defined as what they do. And I think one of the first questions you would have been asked years ago is, what do you do? You know, and it stopped being a question during the recession because it was just an awkward question sometimes, if you remember, about 10 years ago. But I think You know, for example, when I struck off to be independent, to be, you know, as a young man, to be independent, I found a place to live. I went out one evening and found a place to live that evening, a bedsit.
Yeah.
And it was a small chunk of my salary, and I could well afford it and get the hang of living independently by just being in one room and sharing the jacks and the rest of it. Yeah. And it was great, brilliant. And that category of housing disappeared because it was considered unsuitable. And it is, in a sense, part of the reason why so many people are homeless, because there's a whole layer, not ideal by any means, but it was looked at by middle-class people, probably middle-aged, and they were appalled. Whereas if you're a working-class or a middle-class kid of 21, 22, 23, up to 30 maybe, it's grand.
It was freedom.
You know? Absolute, yeah, it was freedom. So you could afford to strike out on your own if you had any sort of a job. And sometimes if you didn't have a job at all. But that's gone now. And I think it's very, very difficult for younger people, particularly working class kids, but also middle class kids to a large degree, to just strike out on their own and to be able to look around them at some stage in their lives and say, this is me, as opposed to waiting for, you know, a few quid to come in from the parents into the bank account or things like that, you know. So it's difficult.
The powerful message from Rosie, I think, for a lot of people was the fact that the homeless crisis affected working people, working families. Because there's been creeping suspicion from people in politics. They've been casting suspicions, as they're overly suspicious maybe of people on welfare and people on the housing list and so on.
Yeah.
Are you surprised now that, given the scale of the crisis we're through now, and we all promised we were going to live our lives differently and see the world differently, the housing crisis is kind of well down the pecking order at the minute, as though it's been solved.
At the moment, yeah. And actually, when you think about it, somebody mentioned Brexit on the radio a few days ago. An almighty joke. I thought it had gone away. So, yeah, the housing crisis, which was top of the agenda brilliantly at the last election, has disappeared back down the agenda. But I suppose who's to know what will happen, you know, in the meantime. But I noticed that, you know, even the PUP, the PUP payment, suddenly, you know, earlier in the week, we were being told that basically it's the dole and you have to go and get a job.
Yeah.
You know, so the attitude has shifted somehow since March. And it's as if, yeah, anybody who is in receipt of money from the state is some of a sponger. Mm-hmm. You know, and I thought maybe, you know, I suppose naively, I thought maybe with the, you know, the end of the difference, or the temporary end of the difference between public health and private health and things like this, that we'd, you know, rethink how we do these things. But, and maybe we still will, but it's dispiriting, really, when you hear that.
The Italian 90 feeling of March, April, feels 30 years ago as well, isn't it?
At the moment it does, yeah. But it's, I mean, I went to see the exhibition there on Wednesday morning. And I got the bus into town for the first time, and it was grand. It was nice looking out the window for the first time since March. I strolled through town early morning. It seemed a bit desolate, but later on it was filling up, and it was a bit like town. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I went to the exhibition, and it really was great. It was great to be at something again, you know?
Yeah.
I hadn't been to anything since March, and it was really, really nice just to be in the room and looking at this stuff. It's really good. Visually, it's terrific. It's great fun as well, and all sorts of. I'd forgotten about the T-shirts. Do you remember the T-shirts?
I vaguely remember. I would have been, you know, I definitely had a Give It A Lash Jack T-shirt, or Jack the Lad T-shirt.
There'd be T-shirts on the streets within hours, and sometimes even sooner, of a match being over, you know. It was amazing. They were wet. People were putting kind of...
The ink is still
possibly dangerous. Probably their skin was burning on them.
And it wouldn't last one wash in the washing machine. It would just be gone.
That was it. Yeah. It was a tea towel. Yeah, with sleeves.
Do you must be missing pubs.
Do you know? Yeah, in a way, I'm missing my friends. Mm-hmm. I really haven't gone into a pub since the, you know, the idea that you have to have what do they call it, a substantial meal,
yeah.
Which must cost £9. I'd love to be in the room where they're coming up with this. Yeah. I can see why they want to be careful or whatever, but I'm happy enough to waste till You know, I'm not happy. You know, I'm not obviously not going to wait till everything is back to normal, because there's a possibility that will never be the case, you know. Mm-hmm. But I'm happy to wait till you can just walk into a pub and have a drink, and even if you can't stay too long. But I tell you, I meet friends on Zoom. We uh-huh. normally meet on a Thursday night, and we've been meeting, not last night, but we've been meeting most Thursdays. And one of the great things about a pub is the ambient noise, because when you're with a couple of friends on Zoom and nobody's talking, it's excruciating.
It fills in the gap.
So the telly in the corner, it may be annoying at times, but I tell you, it does serve a function.
Yeah, those dramatic moments of silence between men in pubs. Maybe that's what's missing. But you're keeping in touch with friends anyway through the Zoom. Is it a poor substitute for the pub though?
Oh, Jesus, yeah, no, it's as with most things. Like, Zoom meetings, work meetings are actually, I don't have all that many, but, you know, they're not too bad. I mean, particularly when you're at a certain stage in a piece of work, say a production of some sort, there's no need, you say, for example, to go to London or go to, you know, across the city or whatever. A short meeting on Zoom will do the trick. So I'm sold in some ways, but no, it's more or less, I've heard people saying that the future of third level education is going to be online. And you know what? They're missing the point. You don't go to college to learn. You go to college to mingle, to meet people, to socialise.
It's a rite of passage, isn't it? For adulthood.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I'd miss more than anything else, yeah. Because I work alone all day as well, you know, so.
Yeah. And you work every day?
I work Monday to Friday.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you put in the hours as a writer, as though it's a regular gig.
I do. Yeah, it's I've always treated it as a job, and I have little targets to reach, you know, each day, and I kind of self-imposed deadlines. And during the pandemic or the lockdown, and that I always tried to send off some sort of piece of work at the end of the week, you know, work in progress or something, just to say that, well, I did that this week, you know.
Yeah.
But it's part of the, you know, when you work alone, you have to have these little tricks.
And your latest novel, Love, was out. What can we look forward to hearing or seeing from you next?
I'm writing short stories at the moment. I thought it was the best way for me personally to try and capture the moments. I was writing a novel and it's set in the present day, but I realised, you know, in early March, I didn't know what the present day meant. You know, it was a different experience every time you turned on the radio.
Time disappeared.
So I decided I'd write short stories. So I just finished the third one there, sent it off to my agent yesterday.
Very good. And so it's lockdown based, is it?
Yeah, this one I finished is just, it's narrated by two people, and one of them is a woman, and she availed of the lockdown to disappear.
Right. So she kind of took the advantages of it.
She just, she thought, well, in sometimes she worked out the logic later, but she just walked out the door. And it was the perfect timing.
Will that be out next year, do you think?
I hope so, yeah. Yeah, I hope so. I think I've done makings of a collection in my head, but I have to write them, obviously. But I finished three, and I'd like to do about 10.
Right.
You know, 10 seems like a good number for a book, doesn't it?
We look forward to that.
But, Love is out in October. It was supposed to come out in March. It was supposed to come out in May, and they rightly postponed it. It was disappointing at the time, but it was the right decision. Yeah. So it's out in October.
That's out in October. Great. And the Italia 90 exhibition is open.
It opens today, I think.
It's open today.
Yeah.
It's open tomorrow,
it's really
actually.
Good.
Tomorrow is the opening of the Little Museum.
Oh, is it? Right.
And all the memories will come flooding back for people.
Yeah, and a lot more. I mean, I was so much that I'd forgotten. And, you know, a good recall. But visually, the little things I'd forgotten. Haircuts. You tend to forget, and because footballers at the time more or less had the same haircut, really, they didn't, you know, they weren't, it wasn't the Paul Pogba generation, so they all really had the same haircut. But those of us who didn't play football, the haircuts are really, so the haircuts and the tracksuits.
That's a very specific memory there. Remember the big the baggy tracksuits, shell tracksuits. The texts are coming in, Roddy. Somebody says, for me the best line for the van was the kid looking for a Dunphy and chips.
All right.
This is Mike and Roscommon. 1990 was a great sporting year. Italia 90 and Cork winning the double, never to be seen again.
That's suddenly something that didn't register with me at all.
Not at all. Jim is in the really real capital there. Roddy sums it up so well. I'm half Irish, an English northerner, but a real Paddy at heart. Jack brought the Irishness early on and authentically loved managing them. The chemistry just worked. Yeah, the chemistry was there, wasn't it?
It was indeed,
they
yeah.
saw him as their dad, I think.
Yeah, and it was lovely things. I don't know, did you see the boys in green? Where Jack, even there was a ball boy or something, that Jack went out of his way to go and have a chat with him because he used to go fishing.
Right, okay.
You know, can you imagine Jose Mourinho doing that?
Well, Jack Charlton used to come up to the Newmarle Hotel in Monaghan. We would all be trying to catch a sneak of the team for training, but it was just because he wanted to go fishing there. Completely agree with Roddy about bedsits. As a student in the late 60s, I shared a bedsit with a friend, shared bathroom, but otherwise it was beautifully appointed, very comfortable, says John in Lucan.
He must be an estate agent now. He's called the lingo.
Susan says disappearance of the bedsits sounded the death knell for housing, and we can still hear it. Bring the bedsits back. Well, actually, the bedsits were brought back, but only after they closed them and turned two into one and then brought them back again when it was all a little bit too late. The Woman Who Walked Into Doors some years ago, probably decades ago, Roddy Doyle's book was televised in 6 episodes. It was the most insightful and poignant depiction of Irish life. Love your writing, Roddy.
It was called Family, and it was 4 episodes, 1994. Yeah. And Ger Ryan played Paula Spencer.
Ger Ryan. Yeah, she was always a feature in adaptations, wasn't she, on the telly?
Oh, yeah, she was absolutely brilliant. But unusually enough, the television series came first, and then I wrote the novel.
On Family, by the way, when you look back now, and particularly the way the world has turned, you know, you're a man writing about domestic violence on women. How do you think that would be received now?
Oh, it's an interesting question, really, because I doubt if there'd be... Well, definitely there wouldn't be remotely the same fuss. I mean, I got death threats because of that when it came out and all sorts of vile messages. Luckily, there was no social media, so it wasn't like that, but... I don't think there'd be half the fuss. I was the subject of sermons in churches. I was debated in the Dáil. I was on questions and answers. When you live a quiet life, it's an amazing and unsettling experience. But I don't think there'd be half the fuss. And I don't think there'd be all that many people denying that domestic violence exists behind closed doors in Ireland.
Yeah. They pretended, wasn't it? I'll give you one last text before we let you go. Hi, I'm a past pupil of Mr. Doyle. He was magic. We all loved Punk Doyle. You had the best teacher's nickname of all time. You were lucky. Listen, a real pleasure talking to you, Roddy.
And you, Oliver.
Take care of yourself. Look after yourself and yours. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Italian 90. Rev it up and here we go. We'll take a break.